me to have a lot of heart. They are not cold academic works, not that academic works are necessarily cold, but they're overflowing with personality and life and, you know, happiness and sadness. They seem to possess a lot of what we would call heart. And in our collection here at Nasser, it's the one area in the library where, because space is at a premium in any library, we can't keep endless duplicate copies of most books. But in the Hushamadian room, there are many copies of some of the books because they seem to represent the lives and the hearts of the people who owned them. So I would just want to ask you to talk about the sort of style of these books. They're kind of hybrid works and have a certain personality.
I think personality is the word for it, right? In many ways, each one of these works is absolutely unique. And you can see it, and the uniqueness, what is personality? It is the imperfections that makes one who they are, right? And in many ways, these works are imperfect in different ways. And these imperfections sort of are what makes this one reason why exploring these works and studying them and reflecting on them makes them so meaningful. The other way in which the personalities come through is just like any personality, it is also a reaction to other personalities. And this too comes across in many of these memory books, right? As I mentioned, there are several memory books dedicated to the same village, right? That's because someone didn't like the way the other person wrote about it. And you see that, right? You have this really effort that, you know, to sort of recreate something in a time when, you know, with technological advancements nowadays, there are different ways in which one can sort of create a model of something that is endangered or even in ruins.
You're listening to Khachik Muradyan on Hushamadyan, Armenian Memory Books. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Back then, these books were the only way to do it, right? Cramming as much information and as much heart and personality that you can almost feel like, if I read this whole thing, I'll be transported back into that land. That is the intention. And this means that there is heart, there is personality, but ultimately, the effort is not about saying, me, and look at all the things I know. It is about, this is the biography of this city, and let me do everything possible to make it come alive, come to life. And I do think that the works that do succeed are the ones that are, you know, accomplish that. And that is one way to perhaps evaluate memory books beyond their scholarly merit, and they certainly do have tremendous, untapped scholarly merits.
Question from online from Greg Aftendilian. Thank you, Greg. Many Armenian letters in the pre-genocide period note the oppressive taxation imposed on Armenian villagers by Ottoman authorities. Do these memory books speak of this oppression, or do they mostly portray a kind of idyllic life before the genocide?
Thank you. You said Gregory Aftendilian. Dr. Aftendilian gave a talk at the Middle Eastern Studies Association conference recently. I believe it was last year, and he told a story that very much stayed with me. So I think it's his grandfather who always used to lament that the fruits and the vegetables in the old country are wonderful and everything here in America is just worthless, right? And the expression apparently which he used was, we wouldn't feed this to our animals back in the old country, right? So there is that idyllic, to go back to his question. I just had to tell that story. But there is that idyllic narrative in a lot of places. But certainly, there's also the whole reason why this sort of genre develops is the genocide and the loss of the homeland. And so the depredations that in the decades leading up to the genocide are documented at length. The massacres, the taxation, the double taxation, the economic challenges, the early waves of, you know, an exodus, all of that is documented. One of the things that sort of brings together many of these, you know, I was saying something about how the personality of these works is the differences and the imperfections of the authors. There's perhaps a few things that really sort of are very similar in many of these works. And it is the way in which they describe the destruction and the loss. It's this world that is very diverse, beautiful, and then it comes crashing down and is sort of, this destruction has some kind of equalizing effect, right? Everything is in ruin. Everything is lost. And there, that is where a lot of these memory books actually meet, in that point of destruction. But that's not where these stories end, right? These stories end with revival, and revival manifests itself in different ways. Rebuilding communities in the diaspora, taking pride in every single person who graduates from prominent universities, every doctor, every lawyer, and you name it, right? And so this effort to rebuild is also manifested in that regard. Or creating towns with the same name in Soviet Armenia, or neighborhoods in different parts of the diaspora. All of this is sort of, again, saying that, you know, you couldn't destroy us. You could not, you know, take us out. And that is also, I think, critical. So there is that, on the one hand, that you feel the oppressive environment, you also feel the effort to create an idyllic world. There's this point when everything comes crashing down and everything is sort of becomes the same, right? Ruin and destruction, and then the ways in which the communities are rebuilt.
Is there any effort, either in Armenia or outside of Armenia, to capture these village histories? And I have a number of encyclopedias. If the village is in the encyclopedia, it gives population statistics and the weather and the altitude, but not a village history per se. So is anything being done about this, either in Armenia or outside?
There is some scholarship that I have seen on the subject, but I do not, unless there's certain projects going on right now that I'm unaware of, I do not think there's anything that is really trying to sustain these histories, right? Perhaps I can say that, you know, in many ways, we appreciate things after they are gone. You know, I mean, this genre of, this whole genre of literature is largely a product of something that was lost. And without that loss, right, it's difficult to imagine it existing, even in terms of trying to document everything, right, and learn and appreciate. So in many ways, and that's true about our appreciation. I've often, in a little bit of a self-critical approach, right, I've often felt that, you know, as I travel to these, you know, Western towns and villages in Western Armenia today, in part of Turkey, and the kind of feeling I get from these ruined churches, right, and the intensity of the emotion, right, when I talk to the locals there, right, is overwhelming. And I think about this sometimes. I think about the fact that when I go to church and I talk to the congregation or the priest, I take it for granted. And we have lost tremendous amounts of, important, historical information, precisely because of this taking for granted, I think. This is not to say that memory books themselves are being preserved and maintained by the families. A lot of these books, some of the descendants can't even read the language, and they just get rid of them. Particularly the manuscripts; those are the ones that are critical, right? And so that is another issue. So we do have that.
What should they do with them, Khachik?
Well, bring them to Nasser. Here's the thing, right? I do think it is important first to appreciate and understand the value and meaning of these artifacts and roadmaps for the people who created them. And anyone here who follows what's going on in Palestine, who follows what's going on in Ukraine, follows what's going on in any other part of the world, in Syria, right, where people lose everything. Entire neighborhoods are razed to the ground, right? And there's this effort to preserve and maintain and rebuild, right? This is what, through photographs and all that technology offers today. These books were all our ancestors had to accomplish that. And as I said, this is just a fraction of what they have produced. Now, it doesn't mean that, all of these manuscripts should be printed because, that's a tremendous expense and there isn't enough, interest in actually, every single volume. But for purposes of research, for purposes of learning about our history, about the past, about the present, right, and for global history. You would be amazed. One of my current projects actually looks at these works in comparative perspective, particularly the ones dedicated to the Holocaust and the Palestinian Nakba. And you would be amazed at the similarities. There are these village histories with memory maps by Palestinians who just lost their village. Their village was destroyed and they could never go back. Same kind of angst, same kind of experiences. And there is a great world history of memory books that awaits to be written one day. There has been recently the Diaspora, the Journal of Transnational Studies, published a special issue with 3 or 4 case studies. But this is a massive, massive and opportunity to explore what home means to us human beings and the kind of transformative power of that feeling and longing for home in people's lives.
This is from Dr. Nick Hakulian. For books not yet translated like Alboyajian's, are there efforts, means to have them translated? This is a popular question when this topic comes up.
Yes, so I am happy to say that some such initiatives are currently underway. George Arjayan has initiated a project to translate all the books on Palu, and that is in progress already. There are efforts, there are publications of memorial books in different contexts as well. It's difficult to imagine the translation of 2,500-page books. Mm. Hushamadyan does an invaluable favor to the community, service to the community, by providing summaries or focusing on specific towns and villages or specific like arts and crafts, religious traditions, customs, etc. But there's a lot more out there. And I think ultimately in the age of AI, and perhaps this is important for this question, there will be a time when we will be able to have all these memorial books in digital format in a database. It will be easy to translate them from one language to the other through artificial intelligence and they will be easily searchable. So I'm not one who would advocate for let's, you know, translate everything and print them and publish them, because I realize that it's not something that's going to suddenly be on the New York Times bestsellers list when it comes out. But on the other hand, I do think that technology is giving us new tools of visiting home and recreating home in different ways.
From Dr. Robert Myrack pointing out that I think he's correct that at least 20 or more years ago, Professor James Russell was one of the first to really call attention to the academic research value of these books. Why do you think it took so long for them to become the subject of academic interest and activity?
I do think that for important constituencies, it was discovered later, for example, for scholars of Ottoman history. Few scholars who worked on, you know, Ottoman history knew Armenian to begin with, right? That has changed in recent years. So that's one. So there is increased interest in materials that are not in Ottoman Turkish, and this was certainly part of it. There have been, and it's important to note, I did not mention, several of these books have been translated to Turkish in the past two decades. That's another important phenomenon. In our reality, I think much of the scholarship has focused on the genocide, and much of what has been sort of explored in that scholarship has had a certain kind of focus on what can be, from the perspective of a lawyer, right? The pioneers of genocide scholarship have worked to document the destruction of the Armenian genocide through a particular perspective that wanted to prove it, wanted to give a sense of the scope of the loss. So in that regard, these materials have been used. But beyond that, they haven't. I think that, and this is very telling, because we also see this in oral histories, by the way. In oral histories, I'm often frustrated with oral history recordings where you have valuable information about the history, you know, about the history or customs of a town in the Ottoman Empire, in Armenian town that is being discussed. The survivor is talking about it. And the interviewer will say something like, tell us about the massacres, tell us about the massacres, right? And I'm thinking, just let the woman talk. It's so you have this kind of approach that for a long time created two worlds. One was our world where we wanted to keep and recreate, etc., and the other was the world outside. And for that, you were, you know, the prosecutor, and things that did not really serve that purpose received less attention.
Dr. Alan Odeon points out that a variant of the memory book was a series of volumes at published by Richard Hovhannissian based on the UCLA conferences, which I think is entirely right. Yeah.
Yes. The difference, of course, is that those are scholarly works. Yeah. The driving force for a lot of these memory books is this kind of, you know, let's collect as much as possible for the Richard Hovhannissians of the future. Mm. And they will say this. They will say, I'm not a historian, but my effort is to save and preserve as much as possible for the future historian. And so the series that was, you know, a Richard series, let's call it, right, is a product of this. But I would say it's a different kind of item, historical document.
And the last question, which I think brings together everything that we've covered tonight, from Nazali Dolgarmadjian. I came by Shushan Tigar through her piece Armenian Women Lost in Obscurity, published in the Journal of Armenian Studies in 2002, which was one of the first pieces I read that pointed out that as heroic and treasured as our materials on Armenian history are, there are still narratives that miss important people in our history, namely women, who played crucial roles in Armenia's identity as a Christian nation. With that in mind, what would you say these village histories do not capture or cannot capture? What do they prioritize, and whose voices do they amplify?
Let me give you a few examples. So one of the projects that I've been working on is based on the diaries and accounts and ledgers of two midwives who served as midwives in Aintab, beginning in 1888. Their two sisters, Armenian, and then all the way into the 1940s. They document some 8,000 births that they officiated, babies that they delivered. Initially in Aintab and then in Aleppo after they are forced out of Aintab. In memory books dedicated to Aintab, these two sisters are not mentioned. They have family members who've become doctors, real doctors, quote unquote. And you see pages and pages about them. So in many ways, in this revival period, right, there's a sense of being proud in our doctors who are going to Yale and getting degrees. But these two sisters, just one example, who single-handedly, I have a photograph that a friend has shared with me of an extended family, three generations. Almost every single person in that picture was delivered by one of these two women. But they don't exist. I have to look for a line here, a reference there, etc., and interviews to add to the massive material that they have in order to be able to tell their story. This is tremendous erasure without even realizing the value of this, right? Now we do, but how do you go back and reconstruct that when the memory book itself has not deemed it important enough, right? You don't read anything about the midwives, about the nurses of the period at all. Mostly women, right, in these memory books. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, overwhelmingly, with very rare exceptions, these are books published by written and published by men.
So let me just make a pitch then. If you do have these books in your home and you don't know what to do with them, or manuscript materials relating to these books and you don't know what to do with them, we're not trying to take your treasures from you. But if you don't know what to do with them, there are responsible organizations such as Nasser and other libraries and archives and institutions that will cherish these materials and do cherish them. So please let such materials never be simply lost.
And may I add something to this,
please,
Mark? I think that even if you want to hang on to these documents, right, I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to give a library a digital copy.
Agreed.
Because someone down the line in the family will not want to hang on to it, or something is going to happen to it, right? So if you have it now, you don't have to give it to me or to Mark. Make sure there's a copy of it, digital copy of it available, and it's, that can be accessible to researchers to do work on these materials.
Indeed. And now please applaud for Hatshik Muradian.
You were just listening to Hatshik Muradian on Hosham and Yan, Armenian Memory Books. He spoke in Belmont, Massachusetts in mid-November 2024. Hatshik Muradian is the Armenian and Georgian Area Specialist at the Library of Congress and a lecturer in Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies at Columbia University. He's the author of The Resistance Network and the editor of the Armenian Review. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Gabor Mate, Bedros Dermatosyan, Tariq Ali, Norman Finkelstein, Ilan Pape, Peter Beinert, and Francesca Albanese. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Hatshik Muradian on Hosham and Yan, Armenian Memory Books, and for Peter Balakian's classic history, The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Mark Mamigonian and Sam Fuqua. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Oneg Dingchian singing in Armenian, Shek Mazerove.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Every year, some caribou herds migrate hundreds or even thousands of miles across the Arctic tundra. But global warming is changing what they encounter along the way, from weather conditions to how much food they can find. So researchers are working to determine how these changes are affecting the caribou. Qianru Liao, a PhD student at the University of Maryland, is studying one piece of that puzzle. She uses GPS tracking and satellite data to analyze how changing ice conditions affect pregnant caribou during their spring migration to their calving grounds.
So they're rushing to the destination to give birth to the young calves.
They need to cross many lakes and rivers, which freeze during the winter.
So if the ice is solid enough, they can directly walk on the ice surface.
But in some areas, ice is melting earlier than it used to, so the animals are forced to choose, swim across the water, which can be dangerous, or walk around it, which makes the journey longer. Liao says if it takes too long, they may not arrive at the calving grounds in time to give birth. So studying how they respond will help determine how global warming is affecting the well-being of these iconic animals. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Looking for a community who will support you on your academic journey? The Student Learning Commons has got your back. The Student Learning Commons is SFU's Academic Success Center. We provide free workshops, one-on-one consultations, coaching, and online tutoring with a focus on writing, study skills, and academic English. All Student Learning Commons programs and services are available to SFU students and are approved by SFU as providing ethical, academically honest support. Learn more by visiting our locations in the library on all three SFU campuses, or check us out online at learningcommons.sfu.ca.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. If you missed your favorite program, don't worry. You can listen to podcasts of our program at cjsf.ca.
You're listening.